So as you probably know, you give these sermon topics weeks and weeks ahead of time. And in some cases, you write the sermon a long time ago, too. And this one is an update of a sermon I've given a couple times. And then this week happens. Every time the week happens, and a lot of those weeks lately, it seems like something happens that you feel like you need to talk about, despite the fact that you already finished your sermon. As if the world doesn't care that I have finished my work and want nothing to happen for five more days so that I can, okay. So I can't not talk today about this tax bill abomination. Though I'm not going to say a lot. First, it's not actually a law yet. We're not quite there. I don't have as much hope as I had a few days ago, but it's not a done deal. It looks like it will, though. And this tax bill hurts tens of millions of low and middle income Americans and gives corporations and the wealthiest individual huge benefits. And it's not as if that had to be that way. Our nation's lawmakers started with a blank slate. Yes, we have a tax system already in place, but they're not tied to keep it or to change only certain parts of it. They could have done anything with our system of taxation, and these are the changes that have been presented to us. I like to keep that in mind, that we could have done anything differently. We're not even tied to this silly reconciliation process if you can get 60 votes together in the Senate, so... Okay, enough of my politicking. I wanted to talk about that and to give this sermon because I actually think this sermon is still the perfect one for today because it speaks of the hope we might find. So our story today, the famous one of the Good Samaritan, tells us how we might judge others and ourselves on whether we are being neighborly. Are we helping people or not? And so in not the smoothest transition I've ever gotten, let me start this sermon. Here we go. There's this movie, you might have heard of it. It came out a few years ago. It's called The Terminator. And if you haven't seen it, I'll tell you all the important stuff. It's okay. And I don't mind ruining it for you because I think it's 35 years old at this point. You've had your chance. Though I still recommend it. I love it. So it's the future, or since we're 35 years later, it's sort of like now, I think, is when it was supposed to take place. But imagine it's a future. So not too far distant, but a little ways off. And this is a world that is ruled by computers and the robots they control, which does not sound too far-fetched, does it? The different part, though, is that humans have nearly been exterminated. There's only a handful of people still alive. And they have formed themselves into a resistance group, you know, resistance fighters. And they are led by a talented, charismatic man named John Connor. You can forget that name as soon as you walk out of here, but it's important for the rest of the sermon. John Connor. The machines have not been able to wipe out the last of the humans in large part because of his leadership. And this is a problem for the machines because those humans keep trying to stop them. So imagine you are one of these computers for a second. Now you have an enemy leader you can't find because this entire resistance is underground in caves and in hiding places. So if you can't find him, what do? Now, you have to take a couple leaps with me, but the answer is actually really simple. I think it's beautiful. You send a cyborg who looks a lot like Arnold Schwarzenegger, it turns out. Something they call a terminator because its only mission is to kill humans, to terminate them. You send this cyborg back in time to kill John Connor's mother because you think you can find her. So if she never gives birth to John Connor, then John Connor will never exist, right? I mean, stay with me here, but it's actually sort of a beautiful, elegant solution, I think. Though it does sort of seem a lot like a shortcut. You know, instead of spending all the time and effort to actually stamp out the resistance, you're trying to find a way to get around it. You take a shortcut. Now, that's not the end of the story by any means. That's just the very beginning, in fact. So the human resistance finds out about this plan and they send one of their own people back in time too, a guy named Kyle Reese. Again, it's a little important for the next few minutes. Kyle Reese. And I'm going to ruin it for you right here. They ultimately do defeat the Terminator. And Kyle finds Sarah and protects her, and then they defeat the Terminator. And in the one night they spend together, Sarah becomes pregnant. So let me lay that out for you. Kyle Reese, who was only sent back in time because the machines were trying to prevent John Connor from being born, turns out to be John Connor's father. The irony. The machines, in trying to prevent him from being born, have ensured that he will be born. The shortcut they tried to take tripped them up. And this is why I'm of the belief, well, that's not why, but it's a good illustration of why I'm of the belief, that shortcuts are unlikely to solve any of our problems, at least convenient-seeming shortcuts that will lead to more problems. Miss Ellie knows that. She didn't even need the movie to teach her that. She said, when you take shortcuts, you miss out on love. So Miss Ellie, this elderly woman on the Carolina Islands who made that several-mile walk through the tall grass with the poisonous snakes on her unsteady legs, and why? To see her friends. Miss Ellie always took the long way, didn't have any interest in a shortcut. And so I'm going to oversimplify here a little, but I'll do it. Our universalist heritage teaches us that God's love is greater than any fault, any evil that exists. Love is more powerful than anything that opposes it. But just because this love is ultimately irresistible doesn't mean we humans don't do our best to resist it. Right? And I'm not just talking about tax bills or criminals or anything here. All of us, we do silly things. We say the wrong thing. We do the wrong thing. We make that joke we should not make. Perhaps things that we would never do if we were a little more careful. And then, of course, it gets worse because we want magic fixes for the problems that we've created through our own carelessness. We want to take shortcuts. So instead of making sustainable solutions, we wait for the next great scientific breakthrough to fix every issue. And I'm all for scientific breakthroughs. I'm waiting for them too, but I think we need to do the work we can right now as we do that too. And in our own lives, instead of speaking to the people we've hurt and trying to make repairs, instead of speaking to the people who have hurt us, we maybe complain to someone else, hoping that they will fix our problem, which almost never works and inevitably makes things worse. Expecting somehow that someone else will want to take on the mission of fixing our problems. Because shortcuts are really seductive, right? But instead, the hard way is paradoxically the easy way or the only way. It's easy, I say, because it's easy to understand most of the time what we should do. It's difficult to do it. I thought of something that happened in my own life in Unitarian Universalism a few years ago at the 2011 UUA General Assembly in Charlotte, North Carolina that year. That's the summer annual assembly of every single congregation, or rather their representatives, several thousand people. That year, I was on the right relationship team. Now, that's a team there that's tasked with addressing concerns anyone at GA has about oppression, to put it in a few words. It's important to us as Unitarian Universalists that the way we are with each other lives up to our highest values. And so when someone is hurt by something that is said or done, the right relationship team is there for them to speak to. And in almost every single case, the first thing we do is encourage the offended party to speak to the person who offended them, which is not fun and not an easy thing to do. I know that. But we encourage direct communication because it's the right thing to do. And so the most amazing thing happened to me on the second day of GA that year. A woman approached me asking if I was on the right relationship team, which was pretty obvious because we all wore bright green neon ribbons or shirts. It wasn't tough to pick me out of a crowd. She said she had been upset by something a workshop presenter had said, and so she had found a different member of the team earlier, and that member of the team had counseled her to speak directly to that presenter, as we often do. We often even volunteer to go with the person if that would be helpful. And so this woman, she did, and she got not only an apology, but had a long discussion that was powerful and meaningful to her. And so she found me that afternoon just to let me know that this had happened so I could pass it back to our whole team. And so right relationships are not just about general assembly or making sure that you use are nice to each other 5 days a year. Though that's a start and more difficult than you might think. I'm guessing, unfortunately, that even the difficult task of making sure that you use are in right relationship with one another is much easier than the larger task, which is the one we're already working on, and that's to have right relationships with everything, everyone. The great minister and writer and thinker of universalism, Clarence Skinner, who was by no means perfect, if you read all about him, you'll find that he had something of a mixed record, especially about racial issues, but this was a long time ago. I'm willing to take what I can get from him while acknowledging that none of us are perfect and that he had significant shortcomings. He said some really wonderful things that I do want to share with you today. He was among the first to sort of firmly and theologically articulate the importance of social justice to our faith. He wrote this: "The agape of the early Christians," agape is a word for love in the Greek, "the agape of the early Christians with its warm personal intimacy will be supplanted by something more formal and organized. Perhaps it will be implemented by governments and be run as insurance, city planning, compulsory health measures, etc. Perhaps it will retain certain qualities of the voluntary system, as in our cooperative societies. Whatever it shall be, it must adapt the principles of our responsibility for all men's welfare," and by men there, he means everyone. Again, this was written 100 years ago. "It will recognize the solidarity of the human race and see to it that the terrible burden of poverty shall be lifted from the shoulders of all people. It cannot endure a world half starving, half free. It must recognize the supreme fact of the unities and universals." Now, we are not there yet. Though when he was writing this, this was before the New Deal, before the Great Society. So in some ways, we've come a little closer, at least in this country. But we have so much farther to go. We can't take shortcuts. We have to make a world where all people are valued, where all have a chance at a great life. We cannot endure, in his words, a world where some are starving and some are free. And this may seem like a daunting task. Is anyone daunted? I'm a little daunted at that. I mean, so what about those times when we don't want to go on? Those times when the shortcut seems like the only reasonable way to go. Back to the Terminator. There's a small scene in the movie, and you might have forgotten about it even if you've seen the movie several times. Kyle Reese, at one point, gives a message from John Connor in the future to John's mother, Sarah, in the past. He says, "Thank you, Sarah, for your courage through the dark years. I can't help you with what you must soon face, except to say that the future is not set. You must be stronger than you imagine you can be. You must survive, or I will never exist." And so I've always wondered about this. What does this message really mean to her? Does the fact that someone told her what her future was like or could be like, since he says the future is not set, does that give her the strength to help make it come true? I think it does. I think that knowing the future can give us strength and power and can give us the will to make it come true. And so today, I want to tell you the future. And I mean it. I know the future is not set, but I believe this. Because I've seen what our future can be like. So here's a little bit about it. In the future, no one has to worry where their next meal comes from because there's enough food for everyone. In the future, we happily pay taxes as we are able to support our common life, understanding that some can pay far, far more than others. In the future, all people are valued for the unique, wonderful beings they are, celebrated both for their glorious diversity and their shared identity as humans, creatures deserving of love and life and joy. And in the future, our world is healthy, pollution is a distant memory. In the future, all people live lives of dignity and grace and love. All relationships are valued. We treat each other with respect and kindness and compassion. And when we mess up, we fix it. And this is no science fiction tale. I know that this can be our reality. And we won't get there by taking shortcuts. There aren't any magical fixes or spells we can use, much as I wish there were. Instead, it takes hard work and real commitment and the courage of our convictions and a whole lot more. But my friends, I have seen the future, and we can get there together.